I mean, if you're anti-subsistence, you're almost anti-rural. You know? That's where it stands.
State lawmakers question Governor Palin's choice for Attorney General. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 8th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an interior river makes a national endangered list.
Oil drilling there, if it does happen, it's going to affect not only Beaver Creek, but all of the Yukon River all the way down. And these are long-term effects we're talking about.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Their mission is to advocate for children and youth by assisting school boards to provide quality public education, supporting student achievement and local governance. Information at aasb.org.
Wayne Anthony Ross today had his first hearing before state lawmakers. He is Governor Sarah Palin's pick for Attorney General. Ross reiterated his opinion that Alaska should not be the only state to have the federal government managing a large part of its fish and game resources. Senate Judiciary Chairman Hollis French pointed out that the litigation on the subject has been settled and asked, "How do we unify the people now?" Ross told the Judiciary Committee that he hasn't changed his opinion, but it's not up to the Attorney General to decide the issue.
If that's your decision, that would be my job to do what I can to get management back. But my job is also to support the Constitution of Alaska, and that provides that the resources belong to everyone. So I would not want to get the resources back by amending our Constitution, for example.
Ross said that resources can be managed so people don't go hungry, but French countered with the federal mandate that subsistence use is based on place of residence and only rural residents have a subsistence right. But Donnie Olson of Nome said he was prepared to vote against Ross's confirmation. He said Ross's way of thinking is the reason that natives had to go 5,000 miles to Washington, D.C. to have their rights protected.
I've had torrents of emails and torrents of communication stating that they have difficulty with your appointment. Now, in the light that, and this is not what I said, this is an allegation that came from me, is that as an appointee looking for confirmation, the answers will be there to placate the legislature until the confirmation is over, and then the war will really start.
Ross says subsistence could have been handled a long time ago if people had been willing to work together. He said Alaskans need to work together to come up with a solution.
I want to be the advocate for Alaska, and I want to work with people that we can face outward and fight the people that don't like what we're doing in Alaska. I don't want to get into a battle between Alaskans again. We did that years ago.
The House Judiciary Committee will meet with Ross Friday afternoon. The confirmation vote is scheduled for next week. Tribal leaders across Alaska are also expressing concerns about his stance on subsistence and tribal authority. Ken Johns is the president and CEO of the Otna Native Corporation in South Central Alaska. Johns says he was surprised that Governor Palin selected Ross. Johns says Ross has a long history of opposing Alaska Native rural subsistence priorities.
And he's always been considered as on the other side. And, you know, when you have state-appointed officials, I think they should be, a person who would look on both sides and, you know, have not really a set view on one side or the other.
Johns says the Attorney General's position has a lot of legal power, and it's problematic if that person comes to the job with an oppositional mindset to issues that are important to Alaska Natives. Alaska Federation of Natives co-chair Tim Tawarik says he's resigned to the fact that Ross will probably be confirmed, but he says because of the state's position that does not recognize tribal sovereignty, he is troubled by the confirmation.
They claim to be protecting the state's sovereignty. And in their view and my understanding of their view, they think that the state of Alaska is the only one that has any sovereignty in the state and not the tribes. The federal government, because of all the treaties that they've had historically, do recognize tribes in Alaska as on a government-to-government basis. And state will not accept that.
Tewarik says he would like to see Alaskans have an opportunity to vote on a constitutional amendment that would bring the state's constitution in line with a federal subsistence mandate of rural preference in times of shortage. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is holding a series of field hearings this month about the country's offshore energy resources. He'll be in Anchorage next Tuesday. He's also visiting the East and West Coasts and spent time today in New Orleans talking about Gulf Coast developments. In preparation for the hearings, the Interior Department's Minerals Management Service released a report this week compiling information about offshore potential. APRN's Libby Casey has more from Washington.
The new report from Minerals Management Service, or MMS, doesn't break new ground. Instead, it gathers together the existing data on the country's offshore resources. It focuses on both fossil fuels and renewables and looks at environmentally sensitive areas. Robert LaBelle is a deputy associate director at MMS and is helping present the report. He says the Alaska section focuses on the North Aleutian Basin, where there are proposed lease sales in a draft five-year development plan. LaBelle says there is documented potential for oil and gas development in the region.
The report comes to the conclusion that there appears to be sufficient seismic information for at least a lease sale to occur. Now, other companies may want to go out and collect additional information, but it was our judgment that there is a sufficient information for at least a lease sale.
But LaBelle says the report also highlights areas of environmental sensitivity in Alaska.
Of concern are the effects of noise in the ocean on marine mammals, especially endangered species and fish. There's been a lot of research and papers written on that.
LaBelle says there are added worries about the impact of development on subsistence fishing and commercial fisheries and concerns about the risk of oil spills and what they would do to the Arctic environment. The report also compiled information about Alaska's shoreline renewable energy potential. LaBelle says it shows the state has an abundance of physical energy, but right now the economics are not lining up.
Alaska is mentioned as being very richly endowed with renewable resources, incredible wind resources, probably the world's best tidal resources, and also marine current resources. But the report didn't really go into it much deeper than that because, as far as we could tell, in the next few years, there isn't that many efforts to try to develop these renewable resources for a number of reasons.
They include the harsh conditions of extreme cold and the lack of large population centers to use the electricity offshore sources could generate. The nation's largest oil and gas industry association, the American Petroleum Institute, says it's waiting to see what the Interior Department does with the report. Spokeswoman Kathy Landry says since it compiles data rather than makes recommendations, she wants to see what direction the Interior Department takes.
What we're waiting for from the Secretary is to get a recommendation of, okay, what do we do next? And he did not give that yet, and he indicated that he was going to use these four public meetings to hear people's views so that he can make recommendations on what's going to happen next, whether there'll be a seismic study or whether money needs to be spent to fill in the gaps of data.
Environmentalist David Dixon with the Alaska Wilderness League says he believes the report shows more research is needed to know the effects of offshore drilling in Alaska.
Nobody said there was no potential there. It's what's the potential cost. We don't know what the potential cost is because we don't have enough information to gauge the potential impacts to the environment and to the cultures of the North Slope and Bristol Bay.
The report and a summary are online at the Interior Department's website, doi.gov. Secretary Salazar will visit Bristol Bay next Monday afternoon to hold a town hall meeting in Dillingham with Senator Mark Begich. Then he'll be in Anchorage next Tuesday for a hearing at the Denina Convention Center. The public is invited to attend, and the day-long hearing will be broadcast on the Interior Department's website. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Restarting the Drift River oil terminal at the base of Mount Redoubt is a complicated process that would take months and may not happen at all. Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Tom Irwin says there's no guarantee Chevron will decide it's worth the expense to bring the facility online again after the volcano quiets down.
We need to give them some time to study their options. And I'm sure they'll be forthcoming just as promptly and as quickly as they can. And yes, economics is an issue. It's an older field in some of this for oil recovery.
Early this week, a tanker picked up nearly 4 million gallons of oil remaining in two tanks at Drift River. More than 2 million gallons of oil are still in the tanks, and they have been filled with water to keep them from floating away in a volcanic flood. Commissioner Irwin says last year, when oil prices were much higher, the state made about $34 million in royalties from Cook Inlet oil. Gas production in the inlet hasn't been impacted by the Drift River closure. Chevron hasn't yet decided how many jobs may be affected. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, state senators compromise on a minimum wage increase.
The people on the lower end of the economic rung haven't had an increase since 2003.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
An environmental group has selected an interior Alaska river as one of 10 in the nation it considers endangered. Washington, D.C.-based American Rivers says Beaver Creek, north of Fairbanks, is threatened by development. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
A portion of Beaver Creek is designated as a national wild and scenic river, and the Yukon River tributary also runs through lands where Interior Regional Native Corporation Doyon has oil and gas development plans. Some of the key acreage is part of a pending land exchange involving hundreds of thousands of acres between Doyon and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Pam Miller with the Northern Alaska Environmental Center says American Rivers' listing of Beaver Creek as endangered resulted from the efforts of several local entities seeking national attention on the potentially precedent-setting land swap.
This has been a very big controversy here in Alaska, but the nation hasn't known much about the issues. So together with the tribal government in Fort Yukon, Fairbanks Paddlers, Arctic Audubon, we put in a nomination stating the case that this was a sneaky backdoor and it threatens not only this refuge, but other refuges and parks and other lands throughout Alaska.
Residents of the Yukon Flats region have mixed feelings about the land swap and development prospect, weighing new jobs and money against potential damage to their hunting and fishing grounds. Fort Yukon First Chief Michael Peter has made up his mind. Peter, who also serves as the local Village Corporation environmental coordinator, says the development proposed by Doyon threatens his people's traditional way of life.
Oil drilling there, if it does happen, it's going to affect not only Beaver Creek, but all of Yukon River, all the way down into the villages and the fish and all the animals that depend on the water for drinking out of. And these are long-term effects we're talking about.
Peter says he knows people need jobs and money, but that subsistence culture is not for sale or trade. Leaders of the tiny village of Birch Creek, which is closer to the area targeted for development, have taken a different stance. Tribal Administrator Angela Ludwig says the village is dwindling and residents welcome oil and gas development.
They're 100% for it. They're anxious to work. You know, I mean, they just want to be able to work and make a living. You know, right, you know, with the high cost of fuel and the economy as it is, people are really struggling out there.
Doyon Vice President of Lands and Resources Jim Mary says American River's focus on Beaver Creek and the land swap is aimed at derailing the deal, just as the new administration in Washington considers issuance of a final environmental impact statement.
After several years of study by experts, publication of a draft EIS, an awful lot of public comment, in our view, we just think that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service needs to complete the environmental impact statement and reach a final decision of record, regardless of outcome.
Mary says development doesn't entirely hinge on the land swap.
It's only a matter of time before oil and gas exploration takes place on private lands in the Yukon Flats, with or without a land exchange. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service just needs to complete the process, make that final decision, whether or not they want to mitigate possible impacts through a land exchange that would take world-class waterfowl habitat out of the path of potential development and put it into federal hands.
Fish and Wildlife Service officials delayed issuance of a final EIS on the Yukon Flats land swap last year, saying the agency needed extra time for land appraisals. The EIS is expected out by next fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Denali Citizens Council is raising concerns about pollution from the Healy Clean Coal Plant. The Healy-based environmental organization wants Golden Valley Electric Association to get a new air quality permit for the long-idled facility before it comes online. Denali Citizens Council President Nancy Bale says new concerns have arisen since the plant was permitted in the mid-1990s.
In recent years, the problems of mercury pollution, even in northern climes from coal burning and other types of industrial activities, have come to the forefront, and there are no mercury standards currently in the permitting. Also, what the plant will do in terms of carbon sequestration has become much more important with the rise in interest in global climate change.
Bale says Healy is ground zero for emissions from the facility, which will be the second coal-fired power plant the utility operates in the community. The Denali Citizens Council wants Golden Valley Electric Association to hold a public meeting in Healy to talk about local air quality concerns. GVEA President Brian Newton says a meeting is being planned, and the public will also have an opportunity to comment as part of an ongoing agency review of the air quality permits for the utilities. For the utility's Healy facilities. Newton says the facilities meet current standards. He says if regulations are tightened, there will be decisions to be made.
Golden Valley has to mitigate that by paying, if it's cap and trade, by paying allowances or by retrofitting the plant to meet the new requirement that's put in place.
The Healy Clean Coal Plant was constructed with $300 million of state and federal funds to demonstrate new technology, but it only operated briefly a decade ago due to operational problems and high repair costs. GVEA officials are giving the plant a second chance under an agreement with the state and Homer Electric. The facility could come online as early as next year. Rochelle Waterman was arraigned in Ketchikan Superior Court yesterday on first-degree murder charges in the death of her mother. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
Waterman is accused of conspiring to kill her mother with Kluwak resident Jason Arendt and Craig resident Brian Riedel. Both men pled guilty in 2004 to the first-degree murder of 48-year-old Lori Waterman. Waterman previously stood trial on first-degree murder charges in Juneau, but that trial ended in a hung jury. Trial Judge Patricia Collins then proceeded to throw out the original indictment against Waterman because crucial evidence against her appeared to hinge on coerced statements made without a parent present. In turn, the state brought forward a new indictment against Waterman, for which she was arraigned Tuesday. In addition to first-degree murder charges, Waterman faces second-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, first-degree attempted murder, and burglary charges. Waterman has pleaded not guilty to all of the charges. Lori Waterman was forcibly taken from her home and murdered on Prince of Wales Island on November 14th of 2004. Her then 16-year-old daughter was participating in a volleyball tournament in Anchorage at the time of the murder. The state is accusing Waterman of asking Arendt and Riedel to kill her mother and with participating in the planning of the murder. Rochelle Waterman and her father, Doc Waterman, attended Tuesday's arraignment telephonically, as did Waterman's defense attorneys Stephen Wells and Beth Trimmer. Ketchikan District Attorney Stephen West and Assistant District Attorney James Scott will be prosecuting the case, which will be overseen by Superior Court Judge William Carey. Carey set the trial date for September 14th. The trial is expected to last approximately 3 weeks and is tentatively scheduled to take place in Ketchikan. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
Alaskans at the lowest pay levels will get a raise if a bill that passed the Senate today gets through the House and is signed by the governor. A measure by Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski would raise the minimum wage on July 24th to match the federal rate of $7.25 an hour and it would get another 50-cent increase on January 1st to $7.75 an hour. The current rate is $7.15. Willikowski originally proposed a minimum wage of $8.75 per hour with an annual cost of living allowance, but said the bill made compromises, resulting in a fair and reasonable measure for everyone involved.
And the compromise recognizes that the people on the lower end of the economic rung haven't had an increase since 2003, but it also recognizes that we are in tough economic times, and this will soften the blow to those small business people that are out there.
But Eagle River's Fred Dyson objected to the government's role in managing any business.
The best thing that we can do for all of our working people is to have an expanding economy and employers desperately looking for and bidding for employees. And any time that I understand that government in North America has tried to control prices or wages, the result always is shortages.
The measure next goes to the House, where another minimum wage bill is in the Finance Committee. If voters in yesterday's Anchorage municipal election still have to decide the ultimate winner of the mayor's office, they certainly had no qualms about sealing the fate of all but one of the bond propositions. KSKA's Len Anderson reports on the election's tax-dominated returns.
Even as they collected congratulations last night from the Election Central crowd, Dan Sullivan and Eric Croft began their runoff campaigning.
The voters are going to have a very clear choice between someone with a proven record of fighting to reduce property taxes, control government spending, and someone who's had pretty much the opposite career in the legislature, wanting greater government involvement in your life.
Dan has put forward a very large tax increase for working Alaskans. We want to do the opposite. The sales tax proposal he's talking about, we think we're going to be one of the highest in the nation, and so you're going to have a lot to hear about over the next month.
Sullivan and Croft emerged as the top two vote recipients from a field of 15 mayoral candidates. Sullivan was the top winner in the mayor's race, but not enough to avoid a runoff election. Sullivan needed more than 45% to win outright. He got 43% and Croft about 20%. The mayoral runoff takes place May 5th. The biggest ballot winner was Proposition 9, the tax cap adjustment. It received 60% voter approval. Backers said it would lower property taxes by returning to the original way revenues under the tax cap are calculated. Opponents argued, unsuccessfully, it could result in increased property taxes. Property taxes play a role in every Anchorage municipal election, but this year the influence was especially strong. Anchorage voters rejected 5 of 8 bond propositions. And one of those enjoying a voter majority, a public safety and transportation proposition, ended the evening with a meager 58-vote approval margin. That victory could dissolve with the approximate 3,000 yet uncounted absentee and question ballots. Among the defeated propositions, 2 school district bond proposals, park and recreation bonds, capital funding for 2 library projects, and a bond package to enlarge police headquarters and establish a tactical firing range. Only roads and the fire department station renovations and fire truck purchase won with solid voter backing of about 55% each. Anchorage School District Superintendent Carol Como acknowledged with a $97 million combined total, the district bonds were costly, but she also thinks they were entangled in concerns beyond the district's doing.
I think people were frustrated because the assembly is having all these problems with the city budget. We haven't had those problems. We brought in a balanced budget. We had made cuts, and I think there was some tension there that how come the city was having to make all the cuts and the school district wasn't when, in fact, we already had.
Como says perhaps some changes in the bond presentations are needed, like returning to a smaller step-by-step renovation process, and maybe changing the timing of the bond requests as well.
Maybe during mayor election years, we don't put bonds on the ballot because then we won't be the target.
There are also 4 school board seats up for election. The results are still unofficial. About 25% of Anchorage's registered voters cast ballots. That compares to around 35% 3 years ago for the last mayor's election. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Preventative medicine is a luxury in our current healthcare system, but that's exactly the focus of more than 100 public health nurses in 24 communities across the state. For a series of interviews marking National Public Health Awareness Week, we called one of those nurses in Petersburg. Ann Heisler says her job is to promote good health in the community, which can involve anything from family planning to boating safety.
St. Craig, where I lived before, we did emergency sheltering exercises. I had people come and talk about earthquakes and tsunamis to the school systems. We did mass prophylaxis clinic exercises also. So it's a different focus. It's looking on keeping people healthy and safe instead of treating the illness itself.
What types of health care issues do you deal with the most?
We do a lot of work with immunization to keep children updated so that we have keep them safe from a great deal of different illnesses such as whooping cough, which we've had, as you probably know, in Juneau, 111 cases this fall. And we work with new mothers, educating them on breastfeeding to help keep infants really healthy. And we do a lot of family planning and STD screenings.
Has the bad economy started affecting your patients?
I think slowly here in Alaska and in Petersburg, it's a fishing community and it's still economically quite strong. But there are people coming up here looking for work that don't have health insurance, and there are other people here that don't. And we see them coming looking for health care that I may not be able to provide, and they just don't have any insurance to cover any of their illnesses.
Can you see the preventative care you offer making a difference in the community where you're working?
I think it does. I think there is an impact because we're raising the level of knowledge of people about their health, what affects their health, whether it's tobacco cessation when I'm talking with the teen about birth control. I always try to have that moment with them to help them, and I think it does. I've seen people are very grateful for the information that I've been able to give them to make changes in their lives.
Ann Heisler is a public health nurse in Petersburg. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.